ladies and gentlemen, where I'd like to start. The lecture tonight is dedicated to the memory of Jack McCann. Jack McCann did so much to establish and develop the society through his enthusiasm and genius. And we're very pleased to have Mrs. McCann and Martin with us tonight. Equally, we're very pleased to have Dr. Raymond Gillespie, who lectures in history in Maynooth and formerly in Trinity in Queens. Now, the last direct connection we had with Maynooth was when Cardinal Afi lectured here. Malachy says it was in 1975. And I'm sure nobody will argue with him because nobody else remembers. I know we particularly remember Cardinal Afi. The title of the lecture is The Glens in the 17th Century. Dr. Gillespie's subject Maynooth is history in the 17th century. So let us welcome Dr. Gillespie.
Thanks very much. Can you all hear me down the back? Grand. I'm very glad to be here tonight, if only because it's been a very long time in happening. Some of you will know that last year, when you asked me to come, I wasn't here, I wasn't in the country. And the year before, I was supposed to come, and then my father died at the last moment. That bit of the story will be known to you all. What will be perhaps less known to you was that in 1977, when I first began work on what later turned out to be my PhD thesis in Trinity, which was on Antrim and Down in the early 17th century, and I was in the Public Record Office in Belfast, when Billy Crawford came up to me and said, "Ah, you're working on Antrim, you're really going to have to go and talk to the Glens of Antrim Historical Society." So I've been 20 years coming. I finally got here, and I therefore hope that the wait has been worth it. I suppose what I'm going to try and do tonight is to go back roughly 20 years to when I first started looking at County Antrim in the 17th century, and looking at it from a point of view of the settlement in the early part of that century. And I began with, as I say, a PhD thesis in Trinity that later turned into a book called Colonial Ulster. And it's some of the evidence that I looked at for that book that I want to look at again tonight to try and see if I can get anything new out of it, other than what I said before. Now, I'm afraid that this is not going to be so much a view of the great sweep of the glens of history from the slopes of Tief Bulia. It's more going to be a sort of crawl around Drains Bay. But what I'm going to try and look at tonight really is an area which corresponds to the Barony of Glenarm. To those of you who, and I'm sure I won't need to talk any more about this, the basic geography of the area that I'm going to talk about really is from Larne across there down the 6 mile water valley, which in the 17th century was a very important barrier, because north of that area, right from the 6 mile water valley to the north coast, was the estates of the Earl of Antrim, as you all know, probably the third largest estate in 17th century Ireland, after the Earl of Cork in Munster, the Earl of Clanricarde in Galway, and then the Earl of Antrim, a large Catholic landowner with this enormous estate. It's also an area in which the royal writ in the 17th century effectively does not run. It is the Earl of Antrim's personal fiefdom. And the story, of course, is told about how one sheriff in 1638 tried to serve the Earl with a writ, and the Earl told him that he would give him a bellyful of law and get all his estates quickly. So we're talking about an area which was very much the Earl of Antrim's personal property, and also an area which lay north of the main route for settlement of County Antrim in the 17th century. We'll see a little bit of this before, but settlers tended to arrive at Larne and make their way straight down the 6 Mile Water Valley, down into Antrim Town, Sir John Clotworthy's estate, and that area in South Antrim. And the result is that this area here, the glens that I'll be talking about, really saw very little in the way of settlement during the 17th century. And we'll come back to this again because it's an interesting, I think, an important question. And I'm going to try and look at the area roughly from Larne up north, really not going much further than Glencorp and Cushendall up there. All right, so that's the area really that I'm going to try and look at. And I want to begin with this area. I suppose the simplest way of doing it is to ask ourselves the question, well, where did people live in this area in the 17th century? I suppose that's the most obvious question that we could begin to address. What's the pattern of settlement? Now, we can do this. We can begin to reconstitute what this area looked like, where people lived, how many people lived in what places, from a number of sources. From around the middle of the century. So let's start there, around the 1650s or the 1660s. Well, a number of sources appear for the first time, which help us to see how this world is working. The first source is the cess, or the poll money of 1660, which I'm sure many of you were familiar with. It's a thing that was published by Seamus Pender many years ago under the title of A Census of Ireland for 1659. Which gives you townland by townland throughout most of the country the numbers of English, the number of Irish, and who the principal landowners are in that townland. But I've chosen not to look at that because for County Antrim there is a much more interesting and I think a much more dramatic piece of evidence for settlement around the middle of the 17th century. And that is the hearth money rolls from the 1660s. A new tax imposed on the 1660s, imposed by the king, a levy of money on each hearth. So therefore it represents families or households. And there has been a wonderful piece of work, if any of you haven't been down to the library to look at it, bought it or shoplifted it as appropriate, that is the book by Trevor Carleton called Heads and Hearths, published by Public Record Office in Belfast. Which goes through County Antrim, parish by parish, reconstituting the world as it appeared in the 1660s from the hearth money returns. And what I've done is simply joined up some of his parish maps together. And this is the picture you get. This is what the Glens of Antrim looked like in terms of settlement in the middle of the 1660s. That, of course, is Larne. And then up here, of course, is Glenarm. Two very large settlements. You can see, well, I sharpened it a little bit. You'll see that there were something like 35 houses in Glenarm at this stage, 144 in Larne. And then each dot up here represents a house, or if you like, a family. And from that, it might seem that the story is fairly straightforward. And that is that the population simply reflects the topography. You can see the long fingers penetrating into the mountains with the glens, running down behind into the mountains, most dramatically there, Glenar from Waterford, and then the various glens as you go down, and then coming down to the bottom, Drains Bay down there, and Ballygally, with a lot of settlement there in behind, in that sort of quite rich lowland area. That seems to be, I think, a pretty straightforward settlement. Where the land was good, that in the glens, people settled. Where it was bad, they didn't settle. In other words, up here, up top of Garran, there is very little by the way of settlement at all. A simple story, or so it seems. If you begin to try and put with that map a series of descriptions of what the Glens of Antrim actually looked like in the late 16th and into the 17th centuries, it seems to bear that out. The emphasis which was being put, for example, in these descriptions on the poor quality of the land almost along the glens, almost along the Antrim coast, with the exception of these few glens inside it. Now, it's from the late 16th century that these descriptions begin to appear, for pretty obvious reasons. And that is the wars of the 1590s, particularly the war against Sorley Boy and the Scots, meant that the army had to be able to move around for the first time. And so, for the first time, the English army moves out of Carrickfergus and begins to move north in a significant way, gathering information, making maps as they go. And what do they find? Well, one early 17th century description, which is now in Trinity, describes the glens as rocky, boggy, and wooded mountains. John Dimmock, at the very end of the 16th century, describes the Antrim coast as being backed on one side by steep, boggy mountains, and on the other side by the sea. And around the middle of the 17th century, when that great land survey, the civil survey, is being made of Ireland, the civil surveyors never got as far as detailing the land ownership in County Antrim, but they did leave some descriptions of what parts of the county looked like. And this is what they wrote about the barony of Glenarm. The soil of this barony upon the sea coast is indifferent good. Now, what they mean is this sort of area here, and the area where the people are, up around the front, is indifferent good, generally, though in some places it is craggy, shrubby, and rocky, with great glens. But towards the west and north, where it bounds with the baronies of Antrim, Kilconway, Dunluce, and Kerry, that's this area up here, it is altogether barren mountains and boggy, being somewhat shrubby and wooded at the heads of several glens. And there's a very nice description at the end of the 17th century by, of course, Dobbs of Carrickfergus, the great writer of the description of County Antrim in 1683, where he says, he talks about the road from Ballygally to Cushendun. He says, it is an ordinary petticoat with gold lace about the skirt. And when you think about it, that's actually quite a good description, with the ordinary petticoat up here and the gold lace all around the edge of the area. Now, we think, when we look at this landscape with these people in it, we tend to think of it rather as 19th century people thought of it. That is, we tend to think of the Antrim coast, somehow joined together by a coast road, which takes you through picturesque scenery and so on as you pass up from Larne north. And what we sometimes forget is that that coast road is really only the product of the 19th century. A large part of it is made as a result as for famine relief works in the 1840s, for example. And in fact, in the 17th century, the way in which the people who lived in these glens looked at their world was not north and south, as we think of it, along the coast road, but east and west. They tended to look inland and out to the sea rather than looking north and looking south. So the people, for example, who lived at the bottom of Glengariff or Glenariff would look down towards Ballymena and off towards Scotland, but rarely down towards Larne. It's a world where they're looking north and south, a world where these are really individual little worlds. We're not thinking of a whole series of settlements linked together by roads, but rather this is one world, and that's a world away, and that's another world away down there. So they're all different, almost micro-societies that we're dealing with. And in fact, in 1683, for example, if you were going from Glenarm to Red Bay, that is, if you're going over Garran, it was said that you must have a guide, because, they said, and I quote what Dobbs says, it is very deep in winter, That just means it's very miry or very muddy in winter. Yet some steep passages, ill to ride up and down, and both ways are not to be commended either in summer or in winter. And the main road, the main way road in and out of this area is in fact was not from Glenarm over to Waterford, but in fact from Glenarm back down to Brashane, down the back. So again, this is the pattern of looking east and west rather than north and south. They think, these people think, not in terms of somehow the coast road or the Antrim Glens, but they tend to think in terms of their own glen, their own little piece of settlement. Now, we can look at this picture, if you like, in a rather different way. This picture of a whole series of small communities living in what was really quite a poor area, a marginal area almost, if we look at the distribution of land which was regarded in the middle of the 17th century as being, shall we, what the surveyors who made the books of survey and distribution in the 1660s, what they called unprofitable land. And when they came to map the barony of Glenarm, this is what they found. And what I've done is I have just taken the figures from this great land survey made as part of the restoration land settlement in the 1660s, where land surveyors were sent out. And they mapped, again, townland by townland, the quantity of land in each townland, how much was good land, how much was pasture, how much was arable, and how much was what they described as unprofitable. And you can see here the areas which they describe as unprofitable. And, of course, immediately what stands out is Garran, the area where it was said you shouldn't travel, where it was impossible to get to. More than 50% of that was unprofitable. And then to the north of that, up around where we are now, was decidedly dodgy land, and the only good land, the petticoat, the gold on the petticoat, so to speak, was this area running down towards Larne, which was the very good land. And, you know, almost in this area here, up around Garran, it was in the middle of the 17th century, almost 60% of the land was worthless. You could do absolutely nothing with it. And that shrinks by the time you go down towards Carncastle, parish of Carncastle down here, to less than 4%. So we're talking about an area which in some ways is marginal, but in other ways shows immense variation over quite a short distance, with small societies, most of which have very little contact with each other. Now, this is apparently a very dismal picture that I've been painting to you of the glens in the middle of the 17th century. A poor area. What sort of wealth could we expect people in the glens to have? What was the value, if you like, of land? Here we've just been looking at a subjective view of whether it's profitable or unprofitable. Let's try and look and see, in the middle of the century, what those terms like profitable and unprofitable actually mean. Well, we can do this by looking at a big survey that was taken again in the early part of the 1650s, when the Cromwellian regime in Ireland began to reorganise the parish structure of Ireland. And they made a survey in order to estimate what the income of various Irish parishes were. The income being the tithe that the minister would be paid. Now, the tithe is very important, because the tithe is quite literally that. It's a tenth of the income of each person went to the minister of the established church. So therefore, if we know what the tithe is, then we have some idea of what the wealth is. What's this tenth of the total wealth of that community? And in the middle of the 1650s, the Cromwellian regime gathered together for every parish in County Antrim and other parts of the country as well, a number of people from each parish, and asked them what were the tithes that were paid in your parish before the war of the 1640s. In other words, the tithe that was paid in 1640. And I've taken these figures, and what I've done is I've simply said how many shillings per statute acre were being paid. And you can see the very rich areas of the county immediately. There it is up there, and down towards Larne, and over here, which of course is the very densely settled area around Sir John Clotworthy's lands. That's the very good areas, and then you can see at the same time the very bad areas, not surprisingly up here, up around Tor Head, but perhaps a bit more surprisingly this area down around here, around what is now Lisburn and so on. This is the Conway estate, and part of the reason why that is so badly or so poor, looks so poor, in fact, is it was all settled very late, and therefore it didn't have a chance to get going. But that in county terms, between the very rich and the very poor, the Glens of Antrim actually come out a bit better than the sort of picture that I have been painting for you. That it's been, that it does seem that in fact the Glens were not exactly rich, but perhaps modestly prosperous. You can see that you're in the middle of the range there, something like, you know, 50 shillings for every acre was being collected. Okay, so that gives you some, I think, sort of impression of what the Glens was like. Now, that map is interesting, but it could be a statistical fluke. It could be that, you know, there is a measure, perhaps, of population, perhaps, rather than an actual measure of wealth. So just to check that this picture of the Glens as a relatively, not a particularly rich area, but a relatively rich area, to check if that is actually true, I took the same figures and I worked out what people paid per household, taking the figures of the hearth money. Remember the map I showed you of the hearth money roll, taking the number of shillings that each household in each parish would have paid for the hearth money, for the tithe. And again, you see, it actually even comes out even better. And you can see the rich areas down around here, and again up here with in the middle, Glenarm, coming out not particularly well. Now, that's a problem. That's an enigma that we'll come back to the reason for, as to why it shows up as being very rich in terms of land, but very poor in terms of people. And we'll come back to the reason for that later on. So we've got now a picture of an area which is looks to people who travel through it to be not particularly prosperous, to be seemingly fairly rough countryside. But in fact turns out to be relatively wealthy. People modestly off, if not very rich indeed, if not perhaps not in the same level as Larne or up round Dunluce, of course, where the Earl of Antrim himself was. If not at those very high levels, at least fairly modestly prosperous. Living in worlds which were almost little micro societies, that is, living in, I'll leave that on there for the moment, living in their glens with very little contact to people to the north and south, but lots of contact to the people for the east and west, most particularly Scotland to the east, and down into the centre of Antrim on the west. Now, the question we might ask ourselves now as this picture is starting to grow up is, well, what was the source of their wealth? Where did they get their money? How did they make their money? How did they manage to maintain these modestly prosperous styles? Well, the principal way in which they made their money was through agriculture. And it was agriculture which in some parts of the Glens of Antrim was very intensive agriculture indeed. This part down here, for example, behind Carn Castle down towards Larn, down by Drains Bay, was really very good land indeed. It was described by Dobbs in the 1680s as deep clay, very good ground, but much worn out with ploughing for oats. In other words, it was being intensively cultivated time and time and time again. He also said that it was very good for wheat, surprisingly enough. But no wheat was actually sown because it had been worked out so heavily earlier on in the century. And in fact, we know that James Shaw of Carncastle, in his lease of the 1630s, part of his rent was to be paid in grain, which he was growing on his own estates. So this then is this rich area down here is rich on the back of agriculture, and particularly on grain growing. Now, we can see that in hinting at that, if you like, at all sorts of ways. There is one very interesting body of evidence which is sometimes neglected because of the rows which there are over it. And that is the evidence which was taken in the form of depositions after the rising of the 1640s, which are now all in the manuscript room in Trinity with copies in Balmoral Avenue in the Public Record Office. And these certainly have all sorts of problems attached to them. But they're very interesting for the things that people never meant to tell you. The handwriting is not the easiest, but let me just show you one or two examples of this. You get used to it very quickly. This is a man called John Johnson. Lived at Ballygally. And he's telling you what happened in the early weeks of the rising. And you can see, well, perhaps you can see, he says that what happened, as soon as he was living in Carncastle, see, he was sworn, and in the first year of that rebellion was, he was in Carncastle, and then was, in the first year of the rebellion, was with his children and family in the castle of Ballygally, right? And from there, for example, he went. They went out at one stage. But the interesting thing which he mentions is that at one stage here, he says that they are sent out, his son goes out to collect corn from their barn. In other words, around Carncastle and Ballygally, it's not simply that they have small farms which they're eking a living from. There are large barns in which corn is being stored. This story is repeated on a number of occasions. This actually is his father. This is Robert Jemison, the Robert Jemison we saw. This is his son. You will notice, just off by the way, that John Jemison can't sign his name. He's illiterate. But his son can. In other words, they're a family going up in the world. Okay? And we'll come back to why that might be later on. But just store that away in your mind for the moment. But there he was, you see, in the barn, cleaning the corn when the rebels struck. So they've got barns, they've got lots of corn, which they are, if you like, storing away for future use. And it's not that he was making this up, because his sister tells the same story. Right? She was with her brother in the barn, where they were getting corn for, you know, supply of the castle. So down around this area in the south of the country, then there is money, there is, you know, modest prosperity based on agriculture, agriculture which is not subsistence agriculture, but it's agriculture which is agriculture where you've got large agricultural surpluses which you are storing in barns. Now, clearly, when you go further north and you come up to the area around Glenelg and so on, the land clearly is not as good as it is down here. So what is the wealth up around this part of the country based on? Well, there is very clearly some form of agriculture going on there as well, because we know that. Because again, one of these depositions, which is taken after a very distinctive murder in Red Bay in the 1640s, mentions that two women were killed while they were drying wheat or drying oats in the kiln. So up here, they're growing not wheat, as it was said they could do down here, but oats, which of course is much better for the sort of wetter and damper soils to the north. So there is a bit of agriculture going on, but what is much more important up here to the north is the trading. That this is a much more commercial world. The glen in here is a much more a centre for buying and selling. And this is particularly true of Glenarm. If you look at the establishment of markets and fairs in County Antrim, and you look at the dates of their foundation, you will see that the early of the market, remember that the difference between a market and a fair is that a fair only occurs maybe twice a year, and therefore can be sustained almost anywhere because it doesn't need an enormous agricultural surplus, whereas a market goes every week. So therefore, you need to have a lot of trading going on to establish a market. And where are the earliest markets in County Antrim? Well, Antrim Town. And that's pretty straightforward. That's downwind, if you like, from Larne. That's straight down the 6 mile water bank. Where's the second one? Glenarm. The second oldest of the markets and fairs in County Antrim. Now, why in Glenarm? Well, you remember I said earlier that these people looked both east and west, and particularly it is the trade from Scotland which sustains a lot of the communities down behind Glenarm and along behind Glenarm in the 17th century. John Dimmock, that I talked about earlier on, writing about 1600, said of the glens, he said, where it had many small creeks between rocks and thickets, where Scots galleys do commonly land at either end or on either side, and there are very straight and narrow passages in this country. And in fact, this aspect of trading has been identified as early as 1570, when the Earl of Essex, who was then talking about planting County Antrim, identifies the importance of the castles along this coast, not for military defence, but as trading points, as ways of bringing goods into the country. And the towns which grow up along here, along this coast, Glenarm particularly, and Waterford also, are the entry points, particularly for the Scottish packmen in the 1630s. And as early as the 1630s, when Thomas Monk is writing the Surveyor of the Customs, he talks about the merchants and peddlers discharge at Glenarm where there is no waiter, a waiter was simply a customs official who collected the customs, where there is no waiter, and fill the country full of commodities, whereof none appear in the book, that is, there were no customs charged. The peddlers out of Scotland take advantage of such creeks, unguarded, and swarm about the country in great numbers, and all manner of wares which they may afford at easier rates than poor shopkeepers that live in corporations, and who are beggared by these renegades, and who have no residence or place of abode in this kingdom, but bring over wares, steal the customs, and convey money over in specie, and that to no small value. So these ports, places like Glenarm, are in fact the way in which the Scots peddlers get in and move down the countryside to places like Ballymena, and also over towards Ballymoney and down this way. And the reason they go there, of course, is that Larne, Carrickfergus and Belfast have all got customs officers, whereas the harbours along the coast don't. And the people who live in this area up around here take advantage of that. It becomes almost a smuggling economy for these areas to the north. If agriculture is down here, this is smuggling, and particularly smuggling down through the glens into the inside of the countryside. Now, what sort of scale was that smuggling trade on that it might be able to support people? Well, in 1683, Dobbs again estimated that from Donaghadee to Glenarm, there were something like 1,000 ships coming in every year. And a very large part of those were coming to Glenarm and Larne. So that we really are talking quite serious business here. And the sort of ships that we're talking about are small ships, somewhere between 18 and 20 tons. And certainly by the later part of the 17th century, a small merchant community had grown up in Glenarm. And there are at least three merchants in Glenarm by the later part of the 17th century who strike traders' tokens. That is, because of the shortage of small change in Ireland, they actually strike their own coinage with their name on them. So that we know there is in Glenarm a small merchant community which has got legit, so to speak, by the latter half of the 17th century. Most of what is going on, according to Dobbs, is on one side, what is coming in from Scotland is in the main luxury goods. And by luxury goods, I mean things like, for example, again from the depositions, one woman is knocked over the head, and it is said in Glenarm that some Scottish plaid is taken off her. Now, I mean, that's the sort of stuff that the packmen were clearly bringing in, is Scottish plaid, Scottish cloth. What are they taking out? Well, they're taking out cattle, flax, not linen, not woven up linen. That comes a lot later. It's still the flax which is going out unwoven. Beef, tallow, butter. But interestingly, Dobbs says there's no grain in this trade. Remember, we saw that the grain which was down in there, it's not going out to Scotland. It's going somewhere else. And where it does seem to be going is it's going to Belfast. So that part of the glens, if you like, is looking south, whereas this part of the glens is looking east and west. So we're then talking about at least two worlds, the world down here and the world up here. World of smugglers and a world of much more intensive agriculture down there. Now, of course, smuggling isn't the end of the story. It's not the only thing, of course, which is going on. Because usually allied with smuggling, there are all sorts of other things, and perhaps the most important one is fishing. Because not only is this northern part of the glens a smuggling centre, it's also a very important fishing centre in the early part of the in the later part of the 17th century in particular. The again, Dobbs commenting on the in Glenarm in the 1680s, says, "The sea here affords plenty of fish, but the people are in no way industrious to take them." In other words, around Glenarm, they're not interested in fishing. They have the smuggling. But further north, that is the real fishing centre. It's Red Bay, it's Glenariff, where there is salmon, turbot, plaice, sole, cod, ling, whiting, mackerel, and halibut. And they fish from the shore with nets. And of course, that's a practice which is still going on, fishing from the shore today. And they say that, you know, Dobbs again says they come down onto the beach. And they cut the nets of their rivals in order to make off with their catch. They throw sand in the faces of their rivals and run off with what they've caught. So we've then got, if you like, three bits to the glens. This region, which is modestly prosperous, which I said had particular micro-societies, we have at least three types of small societies. A world down round Drains Bay, Ballygally, which is an agricultural world, which is a world which depends on ploughing, sowing. We have a world around Glenarm, which is a smuggling, a trading centre with Scotland. And then we have a fishing community up round by Waterford with a certain amount of smuggling as well. Now, one of the fundamental bases, if you like, of this wealth, of this modest prosperity, that I've tried to trace the origins of in some places, was, of course, labour. I mean, you couldn't run in the 17th century an agricultural world down there without labourers. I mean, there's almost nothing, there is nothing in the way of artificial fertilisers. There's nothing in the way of underground drainage. Like that, everything has to be done by hand. Again, fishing is all about people going down into the shore with nets. So where did they get the people from? Who were these people that I talked about earlier on, that I showed you the map of the distribution of that population in the glens? Well, in the later part of the 16th century, we know from some of the descriptions that I've quoted and others that the Glens of Antrim was a very, very sparsely populated place indeed. From the end of the 9 Years' War, from the 1590s, we know the lists of people who were pardoned at the end of that war give us some indication of what the population geography of Ireland was. And certainly the best settled part of County Antrim was the Root, up around here, not surprisingly. But the continual comment is that down round here, there are really very few people, and such as they are all settled in these little pockets. There is a tradition, you will read in some of the textbooks, that in fact the Glens was very heavily settled by Scots. Well, that is true in a way, but many of those Scots who came in the 16th century to live in the Glens, in fact, migrated seasonally. They didn't actually come to live in the Glens. They would come for the summer and go back to Scotland for the winter. So it wasn't as though they were permanent residents. They were certainly moving backwards and forwards. And there are certainly surnames which we know are Scottish. For example, the Macaulays, which could be either Scottish or Irish. The O'Gneaves, which could be either Scottish or Irish, both of which are Glen's surnames. And in this way, if you like, there was a sort of mixing of the populations. In the early part of the 17th century, that situation where the glens are relatively thinly settled, and settled in the main with either native Irish or Native Irish with some Highland Scots. And the Highland Scots are really much more confined to this area. Really, they don't come much further south than Glenarm. And again, when you read the depositions from 1641, there are lots of obviously Highland surnames up here, but none at all down here. And that is borne out if we take the list of 1659, that is the census that I mentioned earlier on, the poll money, and we map, which tells you whether people are English, Irish, and it includes the Scots within the Irish. And you can see the pattern very clearly, the pattern I described to you. Almost very little in the way of English or Lowland Scots settlers in the northern part here. But as you go further south, as you get down into this agricultural area, so the percentage of settlers begins to increase very dramatically. And finally, by the time you're down in here, you're really hitting the maximum. This is the area which really is quite heavily settled in the later part, in the early part of the 17th century, whereas this part, the smuggling part, the fishing part, really is being left. The way in which we can see this, I suppose, working in another way, if we try to put some sort of chronology on this, by looking at, shall we, things which are known as the denization lists. And these are the lists of grants of Irish citizenship, effectively, made to those who arrive in Ireland. And interestingly, when you start to look at the earliest settlement, the very earliest settlement, where there are Scots and English involved, you will see it is around Glenarm, the port, the smuggling port, the people coming in to get a bit of the action. And these are in the main Highland Scots coming in. When you come to the south, you will see again that the settlement, in fact, not only is it English, but it's also a lot later. So, again, we have this picture of, if you like, freebooters coming in around Glenarm into the smuggling economy. Very little up around here. And a settlement which is really quite late down at the bottom in here. And much of that settlement in the down at the bottom is really organised by the Earl of Antrim, bringing in many of his own tenants. Some of them are brought in directly from Scotland. More likely, lots of them are headhunted, if you like, from other parts of Ulster. One of the largest of the tenants down in here, for example, is a man called John Shaw of Greenock. And John Shaw of Greenock, in fact, originally had come to County Down with Sir Hugh Montgomery. And he had come from Sir Hugh Montgomery's estate in Scotland. And he was given two townlands by Sir Hugh. But John Shaw of Greenock was an ambitious man and was offered a much better deal by the Earl of Antrim to move across the water and to set up here with a much larger estate. So that, for example, Shaw of Ballygally gets a very big chunk of land in here for which he pays £13 a year. Now, then, so there's a process, if you like, of headhunting going on. Another very good example of that would be a man who settles just in here, again brought in by the Earl of Antrim, Agnew of Agnew's Hill. These are the hereditary sheriffs of Galloway who are brought over and set up with a big freehold in there. These people are brought over, if you like, almost as secondary migrants. They are headhunted by the Earl of Antrim as good tenants. That partly explains why they arrive so late. In other words, they don't come as part of a first wave of settlement. The first wave of settlement comes to Glenarm and to North County Down, and then the Earl of Antrim starts to headhunt these guys and bring them into his estate. Now, as he does this, of course, the more of these people he brings in, the less there is for everyone else. And so, in the 1620s, he sets up, in the southern part of the glens, an enormous set of big freeholds, for which he can charge very substantial rents. But over time, of course, he begins to jack the rents up. So that somebody like Shaw of Ballygally, who in the 1620s had been paying £13, by the middle of the 1630s is paying £24. In other words, his rent has been, you know, close on doubled. And, of course, what is that doing? Well, as you jack the rent up, it's the people on the edges of this area who can no longer afford to pay, and those are in the main the native Irish, and they are squeezed off, and hence you start to get this process whereby the landscape is being, well, for want of a better word, shall we say, you're getting ghettos created in the course of the 17th century as a result of the Earl of Antrim headhunting English or Scottish improving tenants so that the southern part of the estate becomes almost a no-go area for the native Irish. Those native Irish who are down here are being squeezed, and the native Irish are concentrating themselves up here. So we're getting a process of division and subdivision going on within the estate, well, within the glens. Not only in economic terms, not only in settlement terms, but also in ethnic terms as well. Okay, so we have now, if you like, sort of a couple of frameworks to try and describe the settlement. We have this framework of the population where people lived down the glens. We saw that right at the very beginning. Then we have these individual glens, these individual societies with their own economic biases, agriculture in the south, fishing in the north, smuggling in the middle. But there's one other framework that I would like to say a little bit about for trying to understand how this world worked in the middle of the 17th century. And to do that, the question I want to ask, well, how did this man, the Earl of Antrim, do all these things that I've been talking about? How did he manage to actually physically settle a man down here, James Shaw of Ballygally? How did he manage to organise these guys up here, these native Irish guys, to keep them quiet? How, for example, did he manage to deal with his tenants, to organise this massive estate of almost 500,000 acres in County Antrim? Well, the trick, I think, was that he understood the geography very well. He understood, if you like, the territorial framework within which he was working. In the 16th century, the English government really didn't understand how the Irish landscape worked, how it was divided up, how it was organised. And people kept on telling them about these things called the glens, or this region called the glens. But they didn't understand what it was. They didn't understand. They couldn't understand. It wasn't a county, it wasn't a barony, it wasn't any of the traditional administrative units that they were used to. And when they came, for example, in 1603 to make a grant of this area to Sir Randall MacDonald, they described it as the Tua of the Glens, which designated no shire, county, or place of jurisdictions, but hills and villages between them bounded by woods. So that they didn't quite understand what was going on. But the Earl of Antrim fully understood what was going on. And most importantly, he understood that how you managed this sort of landscape, how you organised it and divided it up among the tenants, was by that ubiquitous thing called the townland. And by the early part of the 17th century, the network of townlands in the glens, and this just shows you how complicated it is, the network of townlands in the glens is really, in place. Now, the important thing about townlands is that townlands are about settlement. When we think of townlands and we look at the Ordnance Survey maps of the 19th century, we see a network of townlands with nice, neat borders drawn on them by the cartographer's pen, and we think that's how it was, and that's how the way it must always have been. That's not so. These townlands were used by people as ways of marking out their own territory, of trying to indicate where they would live and how they would organise the landscape. Now, if I just lay on top of that, sorry, the map that we saw originally, you can see very clearly that where the population is also the area of the smallest townlands. In other words, where when people come to divide the landscape up, where there are more of them, they divide it up into smaller and smaller bits because it's worth it. And that townlands are really about organising the population for living. They're not administrative units or anything else. And that really was the point which Randall MacDonald appreciated. And he then, if you like, took over this network of townlands, which he then used to his own advantage by using them as the basic unit of leasing. And what he did was he settled on one townland, one freeholder, who would be responsible to the for managing that whole area. That is, for taking on subtenants and making sure that they were responsible for their rent. Now, just to give you a couple of examples of what he did in order to make this work. This is just, I've put in on the townland map here a couple of guys off. Well, I've taken two or three individuals. This is Agnew of Galloway, and that's his estate down there in Agnew's Hill. This is Shaw, Jim Shaw of Greenock, and this was his estate down here. And then you will see the Stuarts around here, Donald Motor Macaulay and Donald Groom Macaulay, right? And you see what he's doing. He's giving each of them one or two or three townlands, usually all together, but not necessarily so. And these are people who are now responsible. These are, if you like, the head men in their own area. And were we to sit down with the Antrim leases, we could actually replicate this pattern up and down the coast. That he didn't make small leases to small men. He made large leases to important people who he was sure could pay the rent. And there is only one joint lease in the whole of the Antrim estate in the early part of the 16th century, and that's in Glencorp, where there is a lease made to two Irishmen, Gilgroom and John McDerra, who were two brothers, and the lease was made to them together, but it was very clearly specified that they were to hold the land by two equal moieties. That is, they were to carve the land up between them. They were to sort it out among themselves. But the important point about it is that Antrim was principally interested in getting his rent, and he was principally interested in binding one large tenant for his rent and then ensuring that the tenant would collect off the subtenant. Now, that produced a very interesting society. It produced, if you like, a society which was very, first of all, I suppose, very unequal. But it produced a society where very large tenants, such as these guys, would live in one place. And so there grew up a whole series of townlands, which is where these head tenants lived, which became, if you like, the origins of the urban clusters which there are in county on the Glens today. If you take, I've just taken here townlands with houses of two hearths, and than townlands with just two hearths. In other words, a house with more than just one fireplace in it. And you can see that these are the places. That's Shaw of Ballygally, that's Ignew. These are the places where the landlord chooses to put his house. And these are the beginnings, or not the landlord, but the principal subtenant, who, having been leased two or three townlands, places a house, and the others cluster around him. And this means that the way in which the society which grows up in this world, it grows up not as it did in other parts of Ulster. That is a landlord and tenant society regulated by the lease, but a society where a very strong paternal relationship grew up between these large subtenants, if you like, and the Earl of Antrim. That these were, in Scottish terms, his taxmen. These were his agents, his representatives in the localities. And his relationship with them is not simply about landlords and tenants. It is about something much more powerful. It is about this is the chief and his followers. And right into the 1690s, if you look at a list of those attended with the Earl of Antrim for being Jacobites in the 1690s, they are all the people in which the Earl had given leases to in the 1630s of large townlands, just like this. And there's a history of the an early history of MacDonald's written in the first decade of the 18th century, which describes this process. And he says that Randall, Earl of Antrim, bestowed upon his own freeholders and leaseholders. In other words, these were not, you know, anonymous people. These were people to which the landlord had a personal interest. And he had many more freeholders and pensioners that I cannot call in remembrance. That is, many more followers. In other words, this is almost like the old Gaelic world made new again, adapted to new circumstances, to a new world in the early part of the 17th century. So the Glens of Antrim, then, we have a society which is not rich, but not poor. A shining petticoat, a shining gold on the edge of the petticoat, which has, an agricultural world at the bottom, a smuggling world in the middle, a fishing world in the north, which is run very firmly by the Earl of Antrim, its landlord, using the townland as a way of controlling the estate, of letting out large freeholds, and of building around himself a clientage of people like Donoghmore Macaulay, Donald Groom Macaulay, the Stuarts, the Agnews, the Shaws, and so on, who would remain loyal to him right through into the 18th century. Thank you very much.
Questions? Any suggestion as to how the lowly tenants lived at all?
Very little. I mean, these would be the people who were, if you like, the sub-tenants under people like Agnew and Donald Mother Macaulay and so on. The nearest hint that you get to it, apart from the comments about the fishing and the smuggling and so on, is somebody like Agnew. There is a survey of his estate made in the 1640s, and it's the very early 1640s. It's very interesting because, you know, it details the number of horses and the number of cows and all the rest of it. And one of the things that is very interesting is that it's down in this area where agriculture is very important, where ploughing is very important, but there are virtually no horses. So how did they plough? And it turns out when you look at this very carefully that there actually were four or five horses owned by one man, and he would lease them out, you know, and there would be a sort of cooperative action every year. So it's a society which is very inward looking and which is very closed and which is very cooperative, they all help each other, and that seems to be very much the pattern. But it's not, you know, they don't see themselves as linked to any sort of bigger world. It's very much the local society which is very important to them.
the last part of your talk gave an impression of unity or cohesion through the landlord and the subletting system.
Mm.
How is that related to the earlier piece when you were describing the way in which the barriers were being squeezed in certain areas? What's the connection?
Well, the connection is that what is happening is that the way in which the Earl is manipulating the estate is that he seems to take a decision that this area down in the southern part, with the best, the good agricultural land, the Earl on the one hand is very not philanthropic, but a man who has a very strong sense of family, coming from a Scottish Highland clan. So on that, there's that side to him. There is the other side to him, which is that the second Earl was brought up in the court of London, in London, and regularly lost £1,000 on the turn of a card. So therefore he needed money. One of the things which happens is that for this area down here, you can command very significant rents in a way that you can't up here. So the Earl actually more or less puts it out to tender and says, well, who will pay me, £30 for this property down here? And the people in the main who can get the £30 a year together are the people who are used to practicing commercial agriculture and who are used to, the latest agricultural innovations. And they happen to be the settlers, often coming from some other part of Ireland. So what is happening then, if you like, is that down here, they are coming in simply because they can outbid the native Irish. So the native Irish are being continually, squeezed. First of all, this is the agriculture, the good agriculture. First of all, to the edge of that, and then ultimately further north.
But is that a north-south axis in the population movement?
Yes. But that's... it's not so much that it's population movement. It's simply that what's happening is that a layer is being imposed on the top rather than population is being wholesale, shunted off to the north.
The last impression you gave was a very sort of benign, cohesive society.
Yes.
But that, you talked about no-go areas. That's
just a turn of phrase. It's simply that the estate becomes partitioned up for practical reasons. And remember, the Earl of Antrim is himself a Catholic, and a Catholic from Highland Scotland. So someone who would have had a lot of sympathies with, with people in Ireland.
But what was the religious makeup of the Scottish settlers?
Down here?
Yeah.
Entirely Protestant. But again, one of the things which is interesting when you read the depositions in the 1640s, what has happened to a lot of the people down here, and where we have surveys of the estate down here, we know that almost all the sub-tenants under Agnew are native Irish. They're just being squeezed down. And one of the things that comes out again and again and again when you read the depositions is just the shock at what is happening. And they say over and over again, first of all, they say, well, so-and-so did the murder. They actually name them, so they know each other. And they say, and so-and-so said to me. Now, that either means that they could speak Irish or the Irish could speak English. So, there's been a lot of acculturation going on. And, there is a lot of an accommodation being built up together with these people. And when I say that Antrim was benign, he was benign in a way, but benign in his own interests. He is setting up a system which, is Highland Scotland being recreated in Ireland, but it's being recreated for a very specific purpose. It's being recreated so that he can collect his rents.
Well, it's just essentially there's this sort of image of conflict on the one hand. There was the conflict.
Very, very, very little. And part of the reason for that is that in the 16th century, the Glens was just such an unsettled place. So, all these, were it that there was already, a very high density of population in the 16th century, then another layer of people coming in would have meant competition for resources. But in fact, this world is wide open for anybody who wants to come in, and that, so there's almost room for everyone. And in a way, that's where somewhere like this was different to somewhere like North Armagh, you know, which is a very different story altogether. But because there was so little competition, if you like, for resources, so, I mean, so much of the tensions were diffused.
And that would have assisted in the management of the estate?
Yes. Yeah. So, I mean, what Antrim is doing is he's taking a world in the glens, in comparison to the route, which, of course, is different again, and he's taking a world of the glens where, really, there is almost no precedence for organising the society at all. And what Antrim is doing is saying, right, I'm going to organise this, and what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you a lease, a freehold lease, of, you know, five townland, of this area here, say. You are responsible for paying me the rent, and it's your business to collect the rent off the subtenants, but I want my rent. And you are now, you know, my follower. And, you know, it's not simply pay me my rent. There is also this sense that Antrim is your chief, and when Antrim calls, you will rise out, and that's exactly what happened in the 1690s.
And she said that she had come from the Ballymena direction, and she said it's amazing. When I left Cargan, I said, I think I've got to push the whole still territory.
Well, I mean, Ballymena is a very interesting case, because Ballymena is almost the last area in Antrim to be settled, because Antrim can get nobody to take it, because it's the back end of nowhere, you know. I mean, it's too far away from any coast. You know, so if you want to attract settlers to it, it's virtually impossible. I mean, you have to offer them all sorts of goodies, you know, to come down to Antrim, you know, to come down to Ballymena, because it's smack in the middle of the countryside. There's no obvious way down to it. And if you're going down, you know, the Ban, you just keep going until you come to the good land at the bottom, or you're poached by the London companies. And it's not until Sir Robert Dare is brought in the late 1630s on exactly the deal that is done with everyone else around the glens, and that is, I'm going to give you a big lease, you're going to be responsible for this. And Adair, of course, does this, and then clears, you know, he's there about 2 years, and he clears off back to Scotland again and gets involved in the Scottish Covenanter Wars, and then comes back again in the 1650s. And it's really, it's the 1660s, that's the real origins of Ballymena, you know, of the town. And any of you who know, who've looked at the Adair papers in the Public Record Office in Belfast, will know it's the 1660s and 70s when Ballymena is actually being built up, you know, and you can see the leases for the building of Ballymena.
Right, thank you. I would ask
announcements. Two books, Our Own Glens here, it's in a different style, which people may have missed, so we'll just let you see it. And the other book is the one launched by Bobby Sharp and Charlie McAllister, A Glimpse at Glenariff. well worth buying, but I believe there are none available at the moment. And when will they be available again? After Christmas. Well, it's certainly well worth buying. Even the cover of it is very interesting. Never mind what's inside it. The next lecture is on the 16th of January, The Famine in Ulster and Famine Immigration, Dr. Padraig Fitzgerald. Safe home, everybody. Thanks for coming. Thank you.